and welcome back to New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch, your host, and today we'll be talking with Nathan Finney and Brian Lasley about the new book, Redefining the Modern Military, The Intersection of Profession and Ethics. Nate Finney co-edited the book with Tyrell Mayfield, and Dr. Brian Lasley is a contributor to a chapter discussing the Air Force. Nate and Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Nate, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a U.S. Army officer, currently serving out in the great state of Hawaii. Also have been lucky enough to take part in a couple of great nonprofit organizations like Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, Military Writers Guild, and most especially the Strategy Bridge.
And Brian, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. Former Air Force officer who got out to take the academic slash grad school route. Currently a historian working for the Air Force. But in my spare time, I also write about the Air Force and air power in general.
And could you tell us how this book came about?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, we were, so as a founder of the Strategy Bridge, which is an online forum that discusses strategy and military affairs, we were discussing with folks on Twitter about kind of ethics in the profession. And Dr. Pauline Shanks-Curran, who's currently Stockdale Chair Professor at the Naval War College, had tweeted out a comment prepping for a military ethics course, a question about military ethics. And in the process of that conversation, including quite a robust conversation between my co-editor, Ty Mayfield, and Pauline, they determined that there was a lot of interest in the community, profession, and ethics. And so we reached out to her separately and asked her if she'd be interested in writing an article or helping write or support a series of articles on the profession and ethics. And that turned into a series on the strategybridge.org on profession and ethics and that intersection that turned out to be over a dozen articles. And they were really high quality articles that generate a lot of conversation within the community. So Ty and I decided, you know, it might be worth developing this conversation further, expanding those arguments into a full-length edited volume. And so we reached out to some of the folks who were provided the best articles, and about 10 of them agreed to write articles or chapters for this book. In the process of doing that, we realized there were a couple of gaps we didn't have in the series, including on kind of some of the coalition aspects as well as the Air Force. And that's where one of the chapter authors here on the interview, Brian Lasley, came in. We've known Brian from Twitter as well. And so we reached out to him to very quickly put together a chapter focused on the Air Force. And then through that process, we worked with first University of Oklahoma Press and ultimately with USNI Press, the great editors and team there to put this book together.
The book stands on the shoulders of previous examinations of the military and the military profession. Why is it important to re-examine professionalism and ethics now?
Right. Well, history kind of tells us that periods of conflict are followed by introspection and self-assessment by professional militaries. So for all the folks who wrote into this, but particularly Ty and myself, believe that we're currently in the time when professional militaries must again tend to this profession, as we have had, you know, over a decade and a half of conflict. And as the character of conflict is ever changing, and the words that we, the works that we have that guide us through these changes are kind of showing to beginning to show their age. So works like Sam Huntington's Soldier of the State in 1957, Morris Janowitz's book, The Professional Soldier, in 1960, and others were developed coming out of the Korean War, Smorlin's study coming out of the Vietnam War. We seem to, coming out of particularly long conflicts, look back and done very robust study on what those conflicts meant for the professional military, as well as it means for the profession as a whole. And while we've had some books in the recent past, most especially works by like Dr. Don Snyder in 2002 and some work by General Dempsey, who was kind enough to write the foreword to this book, did in the early 2000s. they are starting to show their age, and they're missing some of the aspects that we have seen in the character of warfare and the 21st century profession that we've seen in about the last two decades. So we just thought it would be good to capture some of those thoughts as a foundation going forward on where we might look at the profession as we go into the 21st century.
And how have changes in recent conflicts shifted how we view the military as a profession?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So the first kind of thing that comes to mind are the new aspects of warfare, things like AI systems, higher technology, machine learning, autonomous systems, things like UAVs and underwater vehicles are certainly affecting how we view ourselves as professionals, how as professionals we're using the technology in the conduct of war. So those things certainly need to be taken into account. I think some of the chapters in this book start to get us there. We don't go real deep into things like AI and machine learning, but what we do look at is the role of professionals and how they question the military, how they question decisions that are made, and things like the chapters by Pauline Shanks Curran, who kind of kicked off this project, Dr. Becky Johnson, currently at the Marine Corps War College, really kind of set that foundation of what a profession is as we go into the 21st century.
So does the increased technical nature of war change how we define professionalism in the context of the military?
I think it certainly adds a new kind of aspect that has to be taken into account. I think fundamentally war is a human endeavor conducted by humans on the part of humans in order to have some sort of human effect. But certainly as we employ these new technologies, we integrate them both on the battlefield more as well as with our soldiers, sailors, airmen more. It certainly has to be taken into account. I think all the services are affected by this. But I think probably, you know, the Navy and especially the Air Force in particular. So I'd be interested to kick that over to Brian and see what he has to say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the title of the book is The Intersection of the Profession and Ethics. But with what we've been discussing for the last several minutes here, it could be just as easily the intersection of technology and the human element. And when we talk about advanced technological systems or AI or swarm or UAV or what have you, I think with regard to the profession side of it, it's how do officers in, say, the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force interact with this new technology, and how does the human element kind of blend into that?
And you mentioned officers. How do the questions and the issues examined in the book regarding professionalism vary based on rank? And how does professionalism and ethics factor into military as a career versus the different levels that people are coming into the military at?
Right. And the foundational documents that are written coming out of the Korean War, Huntington and Genowitz in particular, really focused mainly on officers as professionals. So the main elements of the profession were officers. I think as the military has become more and more professional and more technical and become much more of a career versus a conscript military, that profession has expanded to non-commissioned officers in particular, but even just soldiers just coming into the military. There certainly is a education journeyman piece for soldiers coming in their first couple of years, but the same applies, in my opinion, to officers as well. Their first couple of years, I view them more as kind of the journeyman than on their way to being a professional than the professionals. Most people interested in the military and focused on educating and analyzing the military would say that there is a real flip kind of at the mid-grade when you have your officers becoming, you know, going from captains or major, captains to majors about that time frame, or soldiers becoming non-commissioned officers, so pinning on sergeant and above, where those individuals are essentially making a career choice, saying, I'm going to be a career military person. And then they tend to become more invested in the profession, more focused on how they can be professional and they can impact the profession. I think it was Don Snyder in his books and his lectures, he focuses on that transition going from kind of being a consumer of the profession to being a steward of the profession. So focusing on how not only, you know, to be a professional, but how do you develop professionals? What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, I think kind of there's two parts to this. From my own perspective, with regard to the Air Force is a little odd in that by and large, not in its entirety, but by and large, when we talk about sending, you know, the professional soldier into combat in the Air Force, it has traditionally been the officers that go forward into combat, be that the fighter pilot, the bomber pilot, even the UAV pilot. A lot of discussion about whether or not that should translate over into enlisted pilots. And again, I say that I don't want to take anything away from, you know, combat controllers or pararescue men that are largely enlisted career fields. But by and large, the Air Force has often sent the officers forward into combat. I think the second piece to that, with regard to the idea of professionalism writ large, and Nate talked about how it's kind of at the mid-grade level that you decide, this is something that I'm going to take on and go forward with, that I am going to be the full-time, make a career out of it officer. But I think professionalism is something that develops, and it is a lifelong journey. It's at no point, I think, that you go, you know what, I am a professional. I have reached the pinnacle. I am a professional military officer. I think at a certain point, you know, probably in those junior grades, you start reading those texts. You start reading Samuel Huntington, you know, and as a historian, you read Russell Widely. And then it just kind of develops over time, both in your own kind of your personal reading and then in your professional reading, be that at the captain level officers course, the Air Command and Staff College, and on into the Air War College. And of course, all services have their command and staff and war college. But I think it's something that just continues to develop over time.
And you both touched on.
I think it's. Sorry to interrupt. I think it's absolutely a journey that continues from the moment you decide you're going to enlist or join the military all the way to, and I would say through retirement.
You both touched on the issue of education. What's the current state of education in the military, and what do you think is needed?
You know, I said I was going to let Nate talk each time, but I'm going to go ahead and jump in on this one because it kind of bears with my chapter, in that when they were putting the book together and they gave me a call and asked me if I would be interested in writing said chapter on the U.S. Air Force, I was actually at the Air Command and Staff College at the time taking the course as a student. And so when they called me and said, hey, do you have any interest in saying anything about the Air Force? I've got lots of interest in saying what I think. And I think it is both good and bad. It is an evolving process. And I think, again, something the Air Force has struggled with, and that when you have such a small portion, say 20% are rated officers and 80% are more in your support career fields. But at the Air Command and Staff College, focusing largely on that operational piece, how well, how much does that apply to your support career fields? I think they've done a great job, and I can only speak for the courses I've taken down there. They've done a great job at bringing the history, the profession, the war fighting, and they're continuing to develop it each day. And I've often said with regard to this chapter, I felt kind of bad because when I wrote it over the course of a weekend. And at the beginning, it was very much, and another thing I've got to say here. And I hope it turned out to be a bit more balanced on the education piece. Over to you, Nate.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think much of what Brian said is true writ large across the services. I know that Secretary Mattis put a dedicated effort in his national defense strategy and other strategic documents that he's put out there to try and put an emphasis on the developing of individuals and the developing of units through education within the military. In a more kind of historical thread, we've actually got two really good chapters in this book that touch on the education piece. So Chapter 7 by Will Beasley looks at the Navy across time and how education and senior leadership's focus on education really impacted the Navy across time and how important it was that they focus on educating their leaders. And then actually the next chapter, Chapter 8, is by Simon Anglim over in the UK. Who is focused exclusively on the professional military education and really kind of looks at it in a historical context and then kind of where it fits today. And I think both of them would, if you read both these chapters, and both of the authors would say that across time, the military is focused on education, and this may be somewhat service-specific as well, kind of waxes and wanes. There are times when we put a lot of emphasis into educating officers, preparing them both for their duties today, as well as projecting into the future what we would need our leaders to know and do. And there have been times where that has been pulled back. In my own career, that was somewhat pulled back during the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obviously, there was still education still going on. The Army in particular put a focus on putting all mid-grade captains and all mid-grade leaders, including NCOs, through that education process. But because of the wars, there were a lot of waivers. A lot of people either went much later than they probably would have otherwise or able to get out of it altogether. And so operational necessity sometimes overcomes those desires to educate our folks, and other times, maybe when we're between wars, at a time when books like this are most useful, when we're kind of reflecting on past wars and look forward to future wars, that education is probably the most important, and when militaries tend to put their most focus on them.
And I think this is also a fabulous time to point out how the chapters, though each written kind of separately, I mean, we didn't sit around a table and discuss how they would all fit together. In fact, I had not seen them until the proofs started to come together. But I think it's a fabulous time to point out how well the chapters fit together. And Nate brings up Simon's chapter, and I'm just sitting here looking at it right now and how he talks about professional militaries, how they're much more specialized now, that they rely much more on technology to compensate for relatively smaller size. And so that, you know, these chapters really do go together. So we spent so much time talking about technology, how that impacts the future of our armed forces or any armed forces. And it's interesting to see how, you know, Simon ties into that as well.
I wanted to talk to you about Chapter 4, which has a great title, Professionals Know When to Break the Rules. And in a discussion of professionalism, there's an interesting line in here where it says, soldiers become professionals when they can make the best available decision, even when it contradicts the textbook answer, whether that textbook is a field manual, regulation, or strategy. Can you talk a little bit about this chapter and what it means as a professional to use judgment and to sometimes break the rules?
Absolutely. So that Mike Denny wrote that chapter, and it was based on one of the articles he wrote for the Strategy Bridge originally. And his was certainly one of the articles we wanted most for him to build out into a chapter. And part of that is because of how kind of provocative and thought-provoking it is. I think it was yesterday, somebody tweeted out a comment about that chapter, and it started again a kind of secondary conversation about the idea of whether professionals should be breaking the rules, whether it is their duty to break the rules. And so Mike's thesis for his chapter is that a true professional is educated enough and experienced enough that he or she knows when bending or breaking the rules in order to accomplish the mission and meet a higher goal is more important than following a specific order, a specific regulation, or a specific strategy. And I think those of us who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan can probably most relate with Mike's chapter. There were certainly times, I think, when most of us got some sort of direction or overall theory of how to do things. But once we got on the ground and saw the lay of the land and understood better than anybody what was going on, we felt like we had to bend or break things a little bit in order to meet the mission. Now, I think what most people get hemmed up on Mike's chapter is they jump immediately to doing something unethical. So this book is all about the intersection of profession and ethics. And I think Mike would say, you know, you're not doing anything unethical to meet the mission, but maybe you're going against a regulation or going against an order to do it. So I think that piece you mentioned of judgment is key at what Mike was getting at that chapter. And honestly, what a lot of these chapters touch on is that intersection of profession and ethics is ultimately the judgment that we expect and that we educate and experience and give experiences to our officers and enlisted leaders to be able to make that judgment call that maybe may go against regulation or the normal way of doing things in order to accomplish the mission.
And I remember when I first read Mike's chapter, it blew me away because here he is talking about, you know, when is the right time to possibly cross that line, and kind of to echo what Nate says, obviously, you know, as long as it is not, you know, illegal, immoral, unethical, or fat-free, you know, you're going to follow along with it. But one thing I found in how Mike's chapter kind of tied into mine, and this again goes back to something that happened on social media on Twitter yesterday, is I spend a little bit of time in my chapter talking about Colonel Billy Mitchell and how I felt that he was someone, though upheld by the Air Force as an icon, someone that crossed over that line from what I believe is doing the right thing to outright insubordination. And so yesterday was the anniversary of the beginning of Billy Mitchell's court-martial trial. And I had people coming back to me, said, no, he was right. You know, he fought for air power. And I said, no, what he said, the statement that got him in trouble was absolutely wrong. He crossed over from fighting the good fight to outright insubordination. So I remember reading Mike's chapter and just being blown away and then having to myself think about, okay, well, where is that line? When does one cross it? When is the right time to do it? And when is the wrong time to do it? And I think, you know, that there's got to be that fine line between breaking the rules because it's the right thing to do and outright insubordination, which I think clearly none of us support.
Do you want to talk, Brian, a little bit more about the example that you were pointing out and tell our listeners about it?
Yeah, so I happened to come across someone shared yesterday that October 25th, 1925 was the beginning of the court-martial trial of Colonel Billy Mitchell. Billy Mitchell, an icon in the Air Force. And what had happened was the U.S. Navy had an airship that crashed, leading to loss of life of Navy service members. And Mitchell spent the evening composing a letter that he wanted published in the papers. And in that letter, and then when he called the press into his office that day, he essentially used the words treasonous running of the U.S. military. And he used several other phrases, but essentially what he did was, as a colonel, was attack not only the U.S. Navy, who he blamed for the Shenandoah incident, but also the U.S. Army, who were his superiors. So here is an 06 lambasting the running of the, you know, at the time, the Defense Department, and saying that they didn't know how to run things, that airmen feared for their lives, that they knew if they continued to fly under the U.S. Army or the U.S. Navy, they were going to die. And he was brought before court-martial. Now, another interesting aspect of this, which most people don't realize, is that he writes a letter to his wife at the exact same time because Billy Mitchell has a book coming out, Wing Defense, one of kind of the premier texts on Air Force history. And he writes his wife right after he makes the statements that says, now they're going to pay attention and this is going to help us sell books. And I've always thought, well, now, wait a minute. Now you are the one who are using dead servicemen to promote your own work. And I've always really had a problem with that.
So also, in discussion of the military as a profession, in a few of the chapters, there's some wrestling with what does it mean to be a profession, and when thinking about ethics of a profession, who is the professional responsible to? And some of your contributors come to different conclusions about whether you would put someone in the military in the same category as other kind of easily recognizable professions that have ethical codes and obligations to either a client or a person that they serve in that profession. Can you talk a little bit about some of the different conclusions that the contributors came to and what that debate adds to the discussion about the state of the military now?
Nate, if you're okay, do you mind if I start on this one?
No, feel free.
Yeah, so again, in my own chapter, I kind of broke professionalism in the Air Force up into three or four different sections. And I felt that while they were all clearly professional military members aiming towards the same goal, the way they went about it was quite different. So in the Air Force writ large, I kind of divided it up and said that, hey, you've got your traditional operator force, which are your pilots, and I kind of included in there, be they fighter pilot, bomber pilot, or cargo pilot, I kind of felt that they went about doing things in a certain way. And that's a little bit of that Billy Mitchell maverickism that I talk about. You know, that you're going to do what's right, even if you kind of don't like the way that the service is leading you. I said that there were the space and missile professionals, and I felt that that's kind of the vestiges of the old Strategic Air Command, very checklist dominated. And if it does not come in the checklist, then we will not do it and we will not air right or left from this checklist. I also said that I felt that the unmanned aerial vehicle, the drone profession, was kind of coming into its own. And then I also said that there were the support professionals who kind of had to go about things in their own way because they were not those operators. You know, I hate to use the phrase, but on the pointy end of the spear. So I kind of said that even in the Air Force as a professional organization, there were three or four various ways that I considered them to be professionals.
Yeah, so Brian makes some good points in particular to the Air Force on kind of a broader level. Most of the services, particularly the Army, I think, kind of focus on themselves and who is a professional based on the foundational work by Huntington and Janowitz, and Huntington in particular. What they kind of believe is that professions provide a vital service to society, and society is their client. In the U.S. military, that focus is less on society as people and more as a country. So we actually give our oath of office to the Constitution and support and defend the Constitution, which is the foundation of our society. Additionally, professions work within the jurisdiction that they're given. So in our case, it's the application of lethal force on behalf of the U.S., and that we are able to self-regulate. So we have the Uniform Code of Military Justice, where we have certain laws and regulations that we self-regulate both bad and good behavior within the profession, that we are able to earn and maintain trust with our client, so the American people through the Constitution, and that we are given some autonomy to do what we need to do, what society has charged us to do. And of course, we have a lot of good chapters. As you mentioned, there's that question is pretty much the theme that goes throughout all of our chapters. In particular, there's a large focus on the use of doctrine and regulation to kind of guide the profession. That's by Stephen Foster in Chapter 10. There's also a chapter on mentorship. So in the military, like I mentioned earlier, there's kind of like a journeyman process. It's a career that you do throughout your professional time. And part of that is guided by mentorship and people both of peers who have knowledge more than you, as well as superiors, are helping guide you through that. And Ray Kimball in Chapter 9 really takes on that kind of mentorship aspect of the profession and what that means. I think the main chapter that you're kind of thinking is probably Chapter 5, which is Tony Ingeson, our Scandinavian friend, who talks about when the military profession isn't. So he tries to parse out who is a professional and who's not, really kind of focused on those core principles that I talked about earlier. So, you know, maybe the folks who are just providing a service to other military members aren't professionals, and Tony doesn't weigh in one way or the other. He just kind of lays out a framework. Whereas the folks who are at the so-called pointy end of the spear, the ones who are actually doing that service for the American people, whether they're the real professionals or not. So that's, again, that also is a pretty provocative chapter tied together with Mike Denny's.
And how is that debate helpful? Is that aiming to look at the ethical accountability, or how does talking about who falls into these different categories helpful for the military from a strategic standpoint?
Yeah, I'd say it's helpful in two ways. One is institutional. So if you better understand who your people are, what their role is, and what you need them to do within the profession, you can then build the systems around them to kind of create that product, so to speak. Hate to call individuals a product, but essentially create those individuals and those leaders you need. So if some people are, in the case of Tony's framework, if some career fields in the military or functions in the military aren't necessarily part of the quote unquote profession, they're focused on enabling the profession, then maybe you would educate, resource, and provide experiences to those differently than you would those so-called quote unquote professionals who are doing that service on behalf of the nation at the pointy end of the spear. And they would be focused on a different education and experience track. So that's, you know, institutionally, that's maybe one way that conversation is useful. More importantly, and then I think this is why the Army in particular, but I think the service as a whole, are looking at all of their service members as professionals, is understanding what the profession is and people's role in it allows you to create areas of authority and responsibility and buy-in in the people who are coming into the military. So it's a little bit of in a positive way, a little bit of indoctrination to create those professionals so that they're doing the ethical and professional things that you need them to be doing.
And I think I'll bring up Pauline Chank's Courage chapter here. Again, one of my favorites in the book and one of my favorite people to interact with on social media. But when you think about what it truly means to be a professional, and she lays out that body of expert knowledge, that we are accorded, professionals are accorded a certain amount of privileges in exchange for the fact that the profession will self-regulate, as Nate mentioned, and that at the end of the day, the profession operates for the common or the public good. And so I think these are questions that I know I struggle with, even as a separate, what I might call professional historian. But as I relate them to those in the military, these are questions I actually spend some time thinking about.
So going back to a point that Nate made a couple minutes ago about trust, several authors bring up the importance of trust between the military and citizens. And interestingly, in the conclusion, it says fewer members of society have a personal connection with the military or exposure to conflict in a meaningful way. Can you talk more about that statement and the importance of the trust between the military and citizens and that connection?
Absolutely. So one of the core tenets of being a profession is that you have a sense of trust with your client. Your client trusts you to do the things they are charging you to do. They're giving you the autonomy to do. And in order to gain that trust, you have to show them that you're capable of doing it and doing it in an ethical and efficacious manner. And the more that our society is separating the military and their day-to-day life and the things that they do from society, the more possibly the more challenging, at least the postulation that a lot of people discuss, particularly in op-eds, is that the harder it is to build that trust. We have large bases in the United States with a professional military that a good portion of them are career soldiers who spend most of their time on bases or deployed or doing things. And the only time they really interact with the community around them is when they're out with their family, you know, shopping, eating dinner, that kind of thing. And typically the direction that we get from society comes through the Department of Defense and our elected leaders telling us what to do. So there's a bit of a filter there. And as less and less people as a proportion of society are actually serving in uniform, the less they understand what it is like to be in uniform, what it is like to fight a war. Additionally, the more that we keep going back to the same well types of people, families that serve in the military, the less maybe they have a connection to civil life and understand what it's like to not be in the military. And so we as professionals have to spend, should be spending a portion of our time ensuring that we are interacting with society as a whole, that we're communicating what we do, whether as an institution or as an individual, so that people understand what it is we provide to society, that we are professional, show them how we're professional, and honestly, and probably most importantly, that we are effective at what we do when society asks us to go do what we are charged to do, which is the application or the threat or application of force on behalf of the state. And if we are, do not do that effectively, then we lose credibility and trust with society. Anyway, Brian, you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what I wanted to add to that is as the civil-military divide grows, Nate talked a little bit about how, you know, military professionals tend to interact with each other, tend to hang around with each other and their families. And I think to a greater extent, it's even generational. You know, maybe soldiers begat soldiers, airmen begat airmen. And it's, I don't want to say self-fulfilling prophecy, but it is certainly something to consider in the civil military divide. And when you look at, I don't want to use the phrase on a pedestal, but it's become, I think, dangerously close to that, the way that the civilian side holds up the military. And, you know, we can look at the discussions on representation of the military at NFL games or baseball games or any other sporting events. But I do think that when the profession fails, when there is a failure of that trust, that is a big deal. And we can probably come up with dozens, if not hundreds of examples, probably just in the last decade, you know, cheating scandals at academies, cheating scandals in the missile career field, a general officer who does not live up to his ethical obligations. This impacts the government's and the public perception of what the professional is and how he or she does their business. And so I think it's important to recognize that when there's a breach of that trust, there is a visceral reaction to that breach of trust.
Brian, did you want to expand on that story you tell in your chapter about the Missile Corps?
Yeah. And so that's just, you know, one example among many. I think if I remember correctly, I pointed out three different examples in my chapter. One was the grounding of the F-22 fleet, and this was circa 2012-2013. There was an issue with what was believed to be the oxygen-generating system on the aircraft. In reality, it was the harness. It was the way the pilots were dressed. But the F-22 fleet was grounded, and so the pilots of the F-22s were kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. Look, these are very, very motivated individuals. They wanted to go out and fly their aircraft. They wanted to go out and be fighter pilots. But at the same time, there was significant worry about the jet itself. So trying to balance that desire to go and be the professionals, you know, do what society expects them to do, which is be pilots, but at the same time worried about their safety and how their family was going to react. So that was one of the case studies I looked at. The other one that you mentioned is the missile career field. And I said that the missile career field was the vestige of that Strategic Air Command. And by that, if you've ever looked at the way SAC did their business, it was very checklist oriented. And you ran the checklist, twice, and there had to be perfection. And this went over into how we tested our missile operators. There had to be perfection. It had to be 100% every time. And this led to a cheating scandal where answers were being passed around inside missile squadrons. A lot of squadron commanders and group commanders were relieved of command after this. But I said that really what the missile career field needed to do was go back and rely on that Strategic Air Command mentality, go back to the checklist, go back to doing the right thing to kind of, you know, I also hate to use the phrase, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. But, you know, when you're dealing with one of the pieces of the nuclear triad, you know, you kind of expect perfection.
And I wanted to go back to a point that you brought up about how the military is viewed in society. there's some discussion, even just historically, about the abstraction of military service and how society has created a partition between war and the warrior. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about, those concepts, and how that affects the relationship between military and society?
So I think what we typically go back to is the perception of the soldier returning from Vietnam. And the concept, the idea, the actuality of soldiers returning home, not being treated well by society. And of course, you know, go from 1968 forward, burning of draft cards, you know, really the idea that the military was doing something unjust, not right. And so there was all this perception that the soldier was treated very poorly upon his return from Vietnam. And I am not by any stretch saying one way or the other. There are clearly examples of this, and there are clearly studies that show that our perceptions today might not be entirely correct. But what you have over the course of the post-Vietnam era, and look, this includes things like music and film, too. But over the course of the post-Vietnam era, through Desert Storm, where this shifted, where the civil society said, we support the military, we fully back the military. And the pendulum has swung, and I think we're having these discussions today, has swung entirely in the other direction, where the military is now, to a certain extent, put up on a pedestal. And I think there are military professionals who, if they don't have a problem with this, they're certainly concerned that we've swung too far in the other direction. And I'm not saying that this is right or this is wrong, but this is certainly something that inside the military and inside social media spheres we are discussing today is how much support, how much unvarnished glory is too much. Nate, do you have anything to add to that as I kind of flail around here?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I always, whenever this question is asked or this discussion comes up, I always go back to working for a general officer years ago who had served in Vietnam, at least in Vietnam era, towards the end of the war. And him describing how he would have to ensure that he didn't wear his uniform off post, that he would wear a baseball cap to cover his short haircut, that he would... And even when he would do those things, there were times when people would approach him, though he's a soldier, and give him trouble, whether it's spitting on him or yelling at him. And so this was a guy that I was serving with, right? So he was towards the end of his career, GO. I was a junior officer. But hearing those stories and then having the almost opposite experience myself, where when I flew off to Iraq, I landed a couple of places in the United States on our way there, right? One, Bangor, Maine being one of them. And we got off the plane and all our gear to kind of take a break and wait for them to refuel the plane. And it's 2 a.m. and there's 20, you know, people from Maine at the airport, you know, clapping at us, shaking our hands, giving us snacks. And having the same experience when I'm flying back from Iraq, landing in Dallas, and having literally 100 people, cheering us as we're coming off the plane to change flights. And during, you know, having those conversations with senior leaders who saw the opposite and me seeing another, you really get this cognitive dissonance of how much it has changed and how I think as a nation, our psyche looks back on Vietnam and is somewhat ashamed at the way, as a society, maybe not individuals, but as a society, it was a shame we felt the way we treated Vietnam veterans. And as Brian mentioned, that has almost swung to the other end, where it's we, as a society, kind of, as you mentioned, Beth, kind of split between the war and the warrior, right? We want to support the soldier, support the airman, support the sailor, no matter what they do, you know, not going into the ethical, illegal things, but support them and know what they do because they're just out there doing what we ask them to do. And that is certainly good. I would prefer that. And I think that's better for society than it is the opposite, the way that it was at the end of Vietnam. But we have to be very careful that both society doesn't put soldiers and other service members on a pedestal to the point where everyone's a hero and they can't do anything wrong, because we know that's obviously false. And that could lead to allowing the military to do things that are unethical or illegal and getting away with it and shaping the military in a bad way. Additionally, and more concerning to me as a serving member in a pool of many, many veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, the danger of veterans and serving members viewing themselves as separate and apart from society and are being owed things just because they put on the uniform. And so there's this fine balance between understanding that service members volunteer to serve the state and they should be given some sort of credence for that without putting them on a pedestal or giving them the impression that they deserve things above and beyond other citizens.
I wanted to touch back to Brian's chapter on the Air Force, where he discusses a service that experiences silos based on, in part, because they are performing distinct functions. Could you talk about that? And are there lessons that other services can learn in light of increased specialization in driven by technology and other factors?
Yeah, you're making me go back and pick the book up and open the chapter up here. But the Air Force has long struggled with an identity crisis in that, you know, you've got your pilots and even amongst pilots, there is stratification. You've got your space career field, which I think we could all agree is probably getting much more attention in the last 6 months than they have in the last 6 years to a decade. You have your support career fields. And I will say this, I'll go back to my time at the Air Command and Staff College, where I dealt with an Army officer. She was a personnelist, but she was also an airborne and air assault qualified personnelist who spoke about, you know, dropping into drop zones with her troops. And that is not something that you would necessarily experience as a personnelist in the Air Force. And so while I think every service probably has their dominant career field, I think the Air Force has long struggled with how to balance what has been the dominant career field, at least since the early 80s of the fighter pilot, against educating and training and recognizing professionalism in the other career fields inside the Air Force. So, you know, in my time in the Air Force, a short 6 years, there was all this discussion about breaking down stovepipes. But what I talk about in the chapter is, hey, these stovepipes work, and maybe they are not necessarily a bad thing. And I just want to go back very quickly to the idea of the identity crisis in the Air Force. The Air Force recognizes its birthday in September of 1947. I personally don't think that's necessarily correct. I think that obfuscates and ignores a lot of the Air Force's history that occurs before that date. Fighter, bomber, cargo squadrons all trace their lineage and history and heritage back to World War II, and some of them even to World War I and pre-World War I. So I've often looked at that as the Declaration of Independence Day for the Air Force, and not necessarily that birthday. But again, and something that I did write in the book and something that the Air Force, I think, needs to recognize is we focus on innovation, is that the Air Force is a service that is born as much of insubordination as it's born of innovation.
Nate, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yes. So I won't add anything specific to Brian's chapter because he has ably covered it, obviously. Fantastic chapter that I'm really glad we brought in. The aspects of insubordination as a piece of the culture, I think, really adds to the book and is woven throughout, as Brian mentioned. But what I will mention is there are three really good chapters that we have not really touched on. One is by Holly Hewson. It's focused on non-military members on the battlefield and how actually they weave into the profession and they should be considered in the profession, and that is aid workers. So those civilians on the battlefield, they're enabling soldiers that are helping the local populace. And how they have a lot of the same experiences and a lot of the same kind of foundation of a military profession that military professionals do. Another one is by Casey Landrieu, who's really focused on the history of the Army as a profession and how the focus on values is important. So Brian mentions the insubordination / innovation piece of the culture in the Air Force. Well, in the Army, there's a large focus on mission command, following of commander's intent, and values that really drives the culture that's in the Army. And the last piece is by Australian author Jo Brick. She's a lawyer in the Australian Air Force, longtime contributor at the Strategy Bridge. And she focuses on the role of law in the profession. And so all three of those chapters, again, they touch on a lot of the same issues of what the role of the profession is, how ethics plays, and the culture of the services. So I want to make sure I ably covered them as well.
Well, thank you. And we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we let you go, could you tell us a little bit about how the book launch is going?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book officially came out on 15 October, but we were, Ty and myself were lucky enough to be out at the Robert J. Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas on 9 October, where we gave a talk on the book and did our first book signing. So that was a lot of fun, well attended, including by cadets there at the ROTC programs at the University of Kansas. Ty and I have a second iteration of this. We'll be speaking at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in Chicago on 6 November, and doing a book signing after. And then all of our contributors have been great and started jumping on podcasts and interviews similar to this one. And so they've been pushing out the book the best they can across the world, including podcasts in Australia. All of that information can be found at modernmilitarybook.com, which is a website just kind of collates all of the activities of our great contributors, as well as tell people where they can buy the book.
Great. Thank you both for being on the show today and discussing your chapters, your contributions, and your experiences.
Thanks for having us, Beth.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Redefining the Modern Military, edited by Nathan Finney and Tyrell Mayfield, is available now from Naval Institute Press. Thanks for listening to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.